Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take your sources, articles, research, notes, and, well, we dive deep to pull out the key insights.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we're digging into someone really fascinating, but also increasingly complex, John Muir. You probably know him as the father of the national parks.
That's the common title, yeah.
Our mission here is to understand the inspiration, sure, but also the challenge he presents to us now.
And to do that, you really have to start at the beginning. His childhood was, well, intense. Strict Scottish father, fundamentalist Presbyterian, first in Scotland, then on a Wisconsin farm.
Rough start.
Very. His father preached a god of wrath, and it seems Muir pushed back by finding his spirituality outdoors. He essentially swapped the Bible for what he called the Book of Nature.
So that love of nature started super early.
But yeah.
Was there like one big event that really cemented it, a catalyst?
Oh, absolutely. A huge one. 1867. He was working as an inventor, actually, in Indianapolis.
An inventor. Didn't know that part.
Yep.
And he had this awful accident, an eye injury, punctured his cornea. He was blind for about 6 weeks.
Wow. Terrifying.
Totally. And facing potential permanent blindness. Well, when his sight returned, it wasn't just healing. It was like a conversion experience for him. He vowed right then to ditch mechanics and, in his words, devote the rest of his life to the study of the inventions of God. Nature, essentially. That moment set his course.
Okay, so path set. Then came the famous 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf, his University of the Wilderness.
That's the one. And this is where he really develops this this incredibly forward-thinking, biocentric view. He starts talking about all creatures as earth-born companions and our fellow mortals.
Seeing humans as just part of the system, not above it. Pretty radical for the 1860s.
Hugely radical.
Yeah.
But, and this is the tough part, those same journals from that walk, they contain some really disturbing stuff.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Racial biases.
Yeah.
He uses awful derogatory language about African Americans he encounters and indigenous peoples. He basically saw them as, well, not belonging in the landscape.
Yeah.
Out of place. Wow. That's yeah, that's jarring. How do you hold those two things together? This deep love for nature, but such exclusion towards people.
It's the central paradox of Muir, isn't it? And it's something we're still grappling with.
So after the walk, he heads to California, finds the Sierra Nevada, his range of light.
His spiritual home. He explores Yosemite, comes up with his theory about glaciers carving the valley, which was revolutionary then. People thought it was floods or catastrophes.
Right. Challenging the established science.
Exactly. And he starts writing. He becomes this missionary for the wild, translating his experiences, making him a key figure in American transcendentalism, too.
And his writing gets noticed.
Big time. Which leads to that famous camping trip in 1903 with President Teddy Roosevelt. In Yosemite.
Ah, the legendary trip.
That's the one. Just the two of them, plus guides. Muir really pushed Roosevelt, advocating hard for wilderness preservation. And it worked.
So much impact did it have.
Direct impact. It's credited with directly leading Roosevelt to protect something like 230 million acres of public land. National parks, forests, monuments. Huge.
Incredible influence. What was his core idea, his philosophy? Preservation. Okay. Right. Mm. How did that differ from other ideas of the time?
Yeah, he was all about preservation. Believing nature has intrinsic value that should be protected from human interference as much as possible. Keep it wild.
Okay.
That clashed directly with Gifford Pinchot, the first head of the Forest Service. Pinchot championed conservation, sustainable use, managing resources, yes, but primarily for human benefit. Wood, water, etc.
Use versus protect.
Pretty much. And the big flashpoint was Hetchy Valley, also in Yosemite. San Francisco wanted to dam it for water after the 1906 earthquake.
And Muir fought it hard.
Tooth and nail. He famously wrote, "Damn Hetch Hetchy." As well, dam for water tanks, the people's cathedrals and churches. To him, it was sacrilege.
But they lost that one, right? Hetch Hetchy was damned.
They did lose. But that loss galvanized the preservation movement. It really spurred the creation of the National Park Service a few years later, in 1916, to prevent that kind of thing from happening again so easily.
Okay, so a complex legacy even in his victories and defeats. Which brings us back to that uncomfortable side, the idea of unpeopled wilderness.
Exactly. That concept, which Muir certainly promoted, often completely ignored or worse, helped erase the indigenous peoples who had lived on and shaped those lands for centuries, millennia even.
A critical blind spot.
Huge one. And something environmental groups are now having to confront. The Sierra Club, which Muir co-founded, put out a statement in 2020 acknowledging his racist remarks and the problematic history.
Unnecessary reckoning, it sounds like.
Absolutely. It's ongoing. How do you honor the good while acknowledging the harm?
So wrapping this up, Near. He's undeniably pivotal. He fundamentally changed how America saw nature, made it almost sacred for many people.
Definitely. And that famous line of his, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. That's pure ecological wisdom. It still resonates so strongly today.
It really does. His passion is still infectious.
For sure. But here's the thought maybe to leave you with. How do we take that passion, that inspiration Muir gave us for the wild, but move beyond the very real limitations and biases of his time? How do we build an environmentalism that's truly inclusive and just for everyone, inspired by the best of him, but critical of the worst?